Chapter 12 Strange Things in My Mailbox. For a little while, I lied to Kraft about who I was and what I'd done. But the friendship deepened so much, so fast, that I soon told him everything.
"It's so unjust," he said. "It makes me ashamed to be an American. Why can't the government step forward and say, 'Here, this man you've been spitting on is a hero?'"
He was indignant, and for all I know, he was sincere in his indignation. "Nobody spits on me," I said. "Nobody even knows I'm alive anymore." He was eager to see my plays. When I told him I didn't have copies of any of them, he made me tell him about them, scene by scene, had me performing them for him. He said he thought they were marvelous. Maybe he was sincere, I don't know. My plays seemed vapid to me, but it's possible he liked them. What excited him, I think, was the idea of art, and not what I'd done with it.
"The arts, the arts, the arts," he said to me one night. "I don't know why it took me so long to realize how important they are. As a young man, I actually held them in supreme contempt. Now, whenever I think about them, I want to fall on my knees and weep."
It was late autumn. Oysters had come back in season, and we were feasting on a dozen apiece. I'd known Kraft about a year then.
"Howard," he said to me, "future civilizations, better civilizations than this one, are going to judge all men by the extent to which they've been artists. You and I. If some future archaeologist finds our works miraculously preserved in some city dump, we'll be judged by the quality of our creations. Nothing else about us will matter."
I said.
"You've got to write again," he said. "Just as daisies bloom as daisies and roses bloom as roses, you must bloom as a writer, and I must bloom as a painter. Everything else about us is uninteresting."
"Dead men don't usually write very well," I said.
"You're not dead," he said. "You're full of ideas. You can talk for hours on end."
"Blather," I said.
"Not blather," he said hotly. "All you need in this world to get writing again, writing better than ever before, is a woman."
"A what?" I said.
"A woman," he said.
"Where did you get this peculiar idea?" I said. "From eating oysters?" "If you'll get one, I'll get one," I said. "How's that?"
"I'm too old for one to do me any good," he said. "But you're not."
Again, trying to separate the real from the fake. I have to declare this conviction of the real. He was really earnest about wanting me to write again. Was convinced that a woman could do the trick.
"I would almost go through the humiliation of trying to be a man to a woman," he said, "if you would take a woman too."
"I've got one," I said.
"You had one once," he said. "There's a world of difference."
"I don't want to talk about it," I said.
"I'm going to talk about it all the same," he said.
"Then talk away," I said, getting up from the table. "Be a matchmaker to your heart's content. I'm going down to see what goodies came in the mail today." He'd annoyed me, and I went down the stairs to my mailbox simply to walk off my annoyance. I wasn't eager to see the mail. I often went a week or more without seeing if I had any. The only things that were ever in my mailbox were dividend checks, notices of stockholders' meetings, trash mail addressed to box holder, and advertising flyers for books and apparatus said to be useful in the field of education. How did I happen to receive advertisements for educational materials? One time, I applied for a job as a teacher of German in a private school in New York. That was in 1950 or so. I didn't get the job, and I didn't want it either. I applied, I think, simply to demonstrate to myself that there really was such a person as me. The application form I filled out was necessarily full of lies, was such a fabric of mendacity that the school did not even bother to tell me that I was unacceptable. Be that as it may, my name somehow found its way onto a list of those supposedly in teaching. Thereafter, flyers without end flew in. I opened my mailbox on an accumulation of 3 or 4 days. There was a check from Coca-Cola, a notice of a General Motors stockholders meeting, a request from Standard Oil of New Jersey that I approve a new stock option plan for my executives, and an ad for an 8-pound weight disguised to look like a school book. Object of the weight was to give school children something to exercise with in between classes. The ad pointed out that the physical fitness of American children was below that of almost every land on Earth. But the ad for that queer weight wasn't the queerest thing in my mailbox. There were some things a lot queerer than that. One was from the Francis X. Donovan Post of the American Legion in Brookline, Massachusetts, a letter in a legal-size envelope. Another was a tiny newspaper rolled tight and mailed from Grand Central Station. I opened the newspaper first, found it to be the White Christian Minuteman, a scabrous, illiterate, anti-Semitic, anti-Negro, anti-Catholic hate sheet published by the Reverend Dr. Lionel J.D. Jones, DDS. "Supreme Court," said the biggest headline, "demands U.S. be mongrel." The second biggest headline said, "Red Cross gives whites Negro blood." These headlines could hardly startle me. They were, after all, the sort of thing I had said for a living in Germany. Even closer to the spirit of the old Howard W. Campbell, Jr., actually, was the headline of a small story in one corner of the front page. A story titled, "International Jewry Only Winners of World War II." I now opened the letter from the American Legion Post. It said, "Dear Howard, I was very surprised and disappointed to hear you weren't dead yet. When I think of all the good people who died in World War II, and then think that you're still alive and living in the country you betrayed, it makes me want to throw up. You will be happy to know that our post resolved unanimously last night to demand that you either get hanged by the neck until dead, or get deported back to Germany, which is the country you love so much. Now that I know where you are, I will be paying you a call real soon. It will be nice to talk over old times. When you go to sleep tonight, you smelly rat, I hope you dream of the concentration camp in Ohrdruf. I should have pushed you into a lime pit when I had the chance. Very, very truly yours, Bernard B. O'Hare, Post-Americanism Chairman." Carbon copies, too. J. Edgar Hoover, FBI, Washington, D.C., Director, Central Intelligence Agency, Washington, D.C., Editor, Time, New York City, Editor, Newsweek, New York City, Editor, Infantry Journal, Washington, D.C., Editor, The Legion Magazine, Indianapolis, Indiana, Chief Investigator, House Un-American Activities Committee, Washington, D.C., Editor, The White Christian Minuteman, 395 Bleecker Street, New York City. Bernard B. O'Hare, of course, was the young man who had captured me at the end of the war, who had frog-walked me through the death camp at Ohrdruf, who had joined me in a memorable photograph on the cover of Life. When I found the letter from him in my mailbox in Greenwich Village, I was puzzled as to how he'd found out where I was. I leafed through the White Christian Minuteman, found out O'Hare wasn't the only person who had rediscovered Howard W. Campbell, Jr. On page 3 of the Minuteman, under a headline that said simply, "American Tragedy," was this brief tale. "Howard W. Campbell, Jr., a great writer and one of the most fearless patriots in American history, now lives in poverty and loneliness in the attic of 27 Bethune Street. Such is the fate of thinking men brave enough to tell the truth about the conspiracy of international Jewish bankers and international Jewish communists who will not rest until the bloodstream of every American is hopelessly polluted with Negro and or Oriental blood." Chapter 13. The Reverend Dr. Lionel Jason David Jones, DDS, DD. I am indebted to the Haifa Institute for the documentation of war criminals, for the source material that makes it possible for me to include in this account a biography of Dr. Jones, publisher of the White Christian Minuteman. Jones, though subject to no prosecution as a war criminal, has a very fat dossier. Leafing through that treasure house of souvenirs, I find these things to be true. The Reverend Dr. Lionel Jason David Jones, DDS, DD, was born in Haverhill, Massachusetts, in 1889, was raised as a Methodist. He was the youngest son of a dentist, the grandson of two dentists, brother of two dentists, and the brother-in-law of three dentists. He himself set out to be a dentist, but was expelled from the dental school of the University of Pittsburgh in 1910 for what would now be diagnosed, most likely, as paranoia. In 1910, he was dismissed for simple scholastic failure. The syndrome of his failure was anything but simple. His examination papers were quite probably the longest such papers ever written in the history of dental education, and probably the most irrelevant as well. They began, sanely enough, with whatever subject the examination required Jones to discuss. But regardless of that subject, Jones managed to go from it to a theory that was all his own, that the teeth of Jews and Negroes proved beyond question that both groups were degenerate. His dental work was of a high order, so the faculty hoped to see him outgrow his political interpretations of teeth. But his case grew worse, until his examinations became frantic pamphlets warning all Protestant Anglo-Saxons to unite against Jewish-Negro domination. When Jones began to detect proof of degeneracy in the teeth of Catholics and Unitarians, and when five loaded pistols and a bayonet were found under his mattress, Jones was finally given the old heave-ho. Jones's parents disowned him, which is something my parents never quite did to me. Penniless, Jones found work as an apprentice embalmer in the Scharf Brothers Funeral Home in Pittsburgh. He became manager of the home within 2 years. A year after that, he married the widowed owner, Hattie Scharf. Hattie was 58 at the time, and Jones was 24. The many investigators into Jones' life, unfriendly investigators almost to a man, have been bound to conclude that Jones really loved his Hattie. The marriage, which endured until the death of Hattie in 1928, was a happy one. In fact, it was so happy, so whole, so self-sufficient a nation of two, that Jones did almost nothing during that time by way of alerting the Anglo-Saxons. He seems to have been content to confine his remarks on racial matters to workroom jests about certain cadavers, jests that would have seemed workaday in the most liberal of embalming establishments. And the years were golden, not only emotionally and financially, but creatively as well. Working with a chemist named Dr. Lomar Horthy, Jones developed Vivarine, an embalming fluid, and Gingiva True, a wonderfully lifelike gum-simulating substance for false teeth. When Jones's wife died, Jones felt the need to be reborn. He was reborn a thing he had been latently all along. Jones became the sort of racial agitator who is spoken of as having crawled out from under a rock. Jones crawled out from under his rock in 1928. He sold his funeral home for $84,000. And he founded the White Christian Minuteman. Jones was wiped out by the stock market crash in 1929. His paper suspended publication after 14 issues. The 14 issues had been mailed free to every person in Who's Who. The only illustrations were photographs and diagrams of teeth, and every article was an explanation of some current events in terms of Jones's theories about dentition and race. In the next to the last issue, Jones billed himself on the masthead as Dr. Lionel J.D. Jones, DDS. Penniless again, now 40 years of age, Jones answered an ad in a funeral home trade journal. An embalming school in Little Rock, Arkansas needed a president. The ad was signed by the widow of the former president and owner. Jones got the job, and the widow, too. The widow's name was Mary Alice Shoup. She was 68 when Jones married her. And Jones again became a devoted husband, a happy, whole, and quiet man. The school he headed was named, straightforwardly enough, the Little Rock School of Embalming. It was losing $8,000 a year. Jones took it out of the high overhead field of embalming education, sold its real estate, and had it rechartered as the Western Hemisphere University of the Bible. The university held no classes, taught nothing, did all its business by mail. Its business was the awarding of doctorates in the field of divinity, framed and under glass, for $80 a throw. And Jones helped himself to a WHUB degree, out of open stock, so to speak. When his second wife died, when he brought out the white Christian Minuteman again, he appeared on the masthead as the Reverend Dr. Lionel J.D. Jones, DDS, DD. And he wrote and published at his own expense a book that combined not only dentistry and theology, but the fine arts as well. The name of the book was Christ Was Not a Jew. He proved his point by reproducing in the book 50 famous paintings of Jesus. According to Jones, not one painting showed Jewish jaws or teeth. The first issues in the new series of the White Christian Minuteman were as unreadable as those of the old series. But then a miracle happened. The Minuteman jumped from 4 pages to 8. The makeup, the typography, and the paper became snappy and handsome. Dental diagrams were replaced by newsy photographs, and the pages crackled with datelines and bylines from all over the world. The explanation was simple and obvious. Jones had been recruited and financed as a propaganda agent for Hitler's then-rising Third German Reich. Jones's news, photographs, cartoons, and editorials were coming straight from the Nazi propaganda mills in Erfurt, Germany. It is quite possible, incidentally, that much of his more scurrilous material was written by me. Jones continued as a German propaganda agent even after the United States of America entered the Second World War. He wasn't arrested until July in 1942, when he was indicted with 27 others for conspiring to destroy the morale and faith and confidence of the members of the military and naval forces of the United States and the people of the United States in their public officials and republican form of government, conspiring to seize upon and use and misuse the right of freedom of speech and of the press to spread their disloyal doctrines, intending and believing that any nation allowing its people the right of freedom of speech is powerless to defend itself against enemies masquerading as patriotic, and seeking to obstruct, impede, break down, and destroy the proper functioning of its republican form of government under the guise of honest criticism. Conspiring to render the government of the United States bereft of the faith and confidence of the members of the military and naval forces and of the people, and thereby render that government powerless to defend the nation or the people against armed attack from without or treachery from within. Jones was convicted. He was sentenced to 14 years, served 8. When he was freed from Atlanta in 1950, he was a wealthy man. Vivarine, his embalming fluid, and Gingivitrue, his counterfeit gum substance for false teeth, had both come to dominate their respective markets. In 1955, he resumed publication of the White Christian Minuteman. 5 years after that, a lively elder statesman of 71, an alert old man with no regrets, the Reverend Dr. Lionel J.D. Jones, DDS, DD, paid me a call. Why should I have honored him with such a full-dress biography? In order to contrast with myself, a race-baiter who is ignorant and insane. I am neither ignorant nor insane. Those whose orders I carried out in Germany were as ignorant and insane as Dr. Jones. I knew it. God help me. I carried out their instructions anyway. Chapter 14. View Down a Stairwell. Jones paid me a call a week after I found out how upsetting the contents of my mailbox had become. I tried to call on him first. He published his vile newspaper only a few blocks away from my attic, and I went there to beg him to retract the story. He was not in. When I got home, there was plenty of new mail in my mailbox. Almost all of it, from subscribers to the White Christian Minuteman. The common theme was that I was not alone, was not friendless. A woman in Mount Vernon, New York, told me there was a throne in heaven for me. A man in Norfolk said I was the new Patrick Henry. A woman in St. Paul sent me $2 to continue my good work. She apologized. She said that was all the money she had. A man in Bartlesville, Oklahoma, asked me why I didn't get out of Jew York and come live in God's country. I didn't have any idea how Jones had found out about me. Kraft claimed to be mystified, too. He wasn't really mystified. He had written to Jones as an anonymous fellow patriot, telling him the glad news that I was alive. He had also asked that Jones send me a complimentary copy of his great paper to Bernard B. O'Hare of the Francis X. Donovan Post of the American Legion. Kraft had plans for me. And he was, at the very same time, doing a portrait of me that surely showed more sympathetic insight into me, more intuitive affection than could ever have been produced by a wish to fool a boob. I was sitting for the portrait when Jones came calling. Kraft had spilled a quart of turpentine. I opened the door to get rid of the fumes. And a very strange chant came floating up the stairwell and through the open door. I went out onto the landing outside the door, looked down the oak and plaster snail of the stairwell. All I could see was the hands of four persons, hands moving up the banister. The group was composed of Jones and three friends. The curious chant went with the advance of the hands. The hands would move about 4 feet up the banister, stop, and then the chant would come. The chant was a panted count to 20. Two of Jones's party, his bodyguard and his male secretary, had very bad hearts. To keep their poor old hearts from bursting, they were pausing every few steps, timing their rests by counting to 20. Jones's bodyguard was August Kaptauer, former Vizebundesführer of the German-American Bund. Kaptauer was 63, had done 11 years in Atlanta, was about to drop dead. But he still looked garishly boyish, as though he went to a mortuary cosmetologist regularly. The greatest achievement of his life was the arrangement of a joint meeting of the Bund and the Ku Klux Klan in New Jersey in 1940. At that meeting, Kaptauer declared that the Pope was a Jew, and that the Jews held a $15 million mortgage on the Vatican. A change of popes and 11 years in a prison laundry had not changed his mind. Jones's secretary was an unfrocked Paulist father named Patrick Keeley. Father Keeley, as his employer still called him, was 73. He was a drunk. He had, before the Second World War, been chaplain of a Detroit gun club which, as later came out, had been organized by agents of Nazi Germany. The dream of the club, apparently, was to shoot the Jews. One of Father Keeley's prayers at a club meeting was taken down by a newspaper reporter, was printed in full the next morning. The prayer appealed to so vicious and bigoted a God that it attracted the astonished attention of Pope Pius XI. Keeley was unfrocked, and Pope Pius sent a long letter to the American hierarchy in which he said, among other things, "No true Catholic will take part in the persecution of his Jewish compatriots. A blow against the Jews is a blow against our common humanity." Keeley never went to prison, though many of his close friends did. While his friends enjoyed steam heat, clean beds, and regular meals at government expense, Keeley shivered and itched and starved and drank himself blind on skid rows across the land. He would have been on a skid row still or in a pauper's grave if Jones and Koptower hadn't found and rescued him. Keeley's famous prayer, incidentally, was a paraphrase of a satiric poem I had composed and delivered on shortwave before. And while I am setting the record straight as to my contributions to literature, may I point out that Vize-Bundesführer Koptower's claims about the Pope and the mortgage on the Vatican were my inventions, too. So up the stairs these people came to see me, chanting, "One, two, three, four." And slow as their progress was, the fourth member of the party lagged far behind. The fourth member was a woman. All I could see of her was her pale and ringless hand. The hand of Jones was in the lead. It glittered with rings like the hand of a Byzantine prince. An inventory of the jewelry on that hand would have revealed two wedding rings, a star sapphire, presented to him by the Mother's Auxiliary of the Paul Revere Association of Militant Gentiles in 1940. A diamond swastika on an onyx field, presented to him in 1939 by Baron Manfred Freiherr von Killinger, then German Consul General of San Francisco, and an American eagle carved in jade and mounted in silver, a piece of Japanese craftsmanship, a present from Robert Sterling Wilson. Wilson was the Black Führer of Harlem, a colored man who went to prison in 1942 as a Japanese spy. The jeweled hand of Jones left the banister. Jones cantered back down the stairs to the woman, said things to her I couldn't understand, and then up he came again, a remarkably sound-winded septuagenarian. He came face to face with me, and he smiled, showing me snow-white teeth set in gingiva true.
"Campbell?"
he said, only a little out of breath.
"Yes," I said. "My name is Dr. Jones. I have a surprise for you,"
he said. "I've already seen your paper," I said.
"No, not the paper," he said. "A bigger surprise than that."
Father Keeley and Vize-Bundesführer Koptower now came into view, wheezing, counting to 20 in shattered whispers. "An even bigger surprise," I said, preparing to square him away so savagely that he would never think of me as one of his own kind again.
"The woman I've brought with me,"
he said. "What about her?" I said.
"She's your wife,"
he said.
"I got in touch with her," said Jones, "and she begged me not to tell you about her. She insisted it had to be like this, with her just walking in without any warning."
"So I could see for myself, if there was still room for me in your life," said Helga. If there is no room, I will simply say goodbye again, disappear, and never bother you again.
Chapter 15. The Time Machine. If the pale, ringless hand on the railing below was the hand of my Helga, it was the hand of a woman 45 years old. It was the hand of a middle-aged woman who had been a prisoner of the Russians for 16 years. If the hand was Helga's, it was inconceivable that my Helga could still be so lovely and gay. If Helga had survived the Russian attack on the Crimea, had eluded all the crawling, booming, whistling, buzzing, creeping, clanking, bounding, chattering toys of war that killed quickly, a slower doom, a doom that killed like leprosy, had surely awaited her. There was no need for me to guess at the doom. It was well known, uniformly applied to all women prisoners on the Russian front. Was part of the ghastly routine of any thoroughly modern, thoroughly scientific, thoroughly asexual nation at thoroughly modern war. If my Helga had survived the battle, her captors had surely prodded her with gun muzzles into a labor gang. They had surely shepherded her into one of Mother Russia's countless huddles of squinting, lumpy, hopeless, grubbing ragbags. Had surely made of my Helga a digger of root crops in frosty fields, a lead-footed, splay-fingered clearer of rubble, a nameless, sexless dragger of noisy carts. "My wife?" I said to Jones. "I don't believe you."
"It's easy enough to prove I'm a liar, if I am a liar," he said pleasantly. "Have a look for yourself."
My pace down the stairs was firm and regular. Now I saw the woman. She smiled up at me, raising her chin so as to show her features frankly, clearly. Her hair was snow white. Aside from that, she was my Helga, untouched by time. Aside from that, she was as lithe and blooming as my Helga had been on our wedding night.
Chapter 16. A Well-Preserved Woman.
We cried like babies, wrestled each other up the stairs to my attic. As we passed Father Keeley and Vize-Bundesfuhrer Kraptauer, I saw that Keeley was crying. Kraptauer stood at attention, honoring the idea of an Anglo-Saxon family. Jones, further up the stairs, was radiant with pleasure in the miracle he had worked. He rubbed and rubbed his jeweled hands.
My wife,
I said to my old friend Kraft as Helga and I entered my attic. And Kraft, trying to keep from crying, chewed the bit of his cold corncob pipe in two. He never did quite cry, but he was close to doing it, genuinely close to doing it, I think. Jones, Kraptauer, and Keeley followed us in.
"How is it," I said to Jones, "that it's you who gives me back my wife?"
"A fantastic coincidence," said Jones. "One day I learned that you were still alive. A month later I learned that your wife was still alive. What can I call a coincidence like that but the hand of God?"
"I don't know," I said.
"My paper has a small circulation in West Germany," said Jones. "One of my subscribers read about you and he sent me a cable. He asked me if I knew your wife had just turned up as a refugee in West Berlin."
"Why didn't he cable me?" I said. I turned to Helga. "Sweetheart," I said in German, "why didn't you cable me?" "We'd been apart so long. I'd been dead so long,"
she said in English. I thought surely you'd built a new life, with no room in it for me. I'd hoped that. My life is nothing but room for you, I said. It could never be filled by anyone but you. So much to say, so much to tell, she said, melting against me. I looked down on her wonderingly. Her skin was soft and clear. She was amazingly well-preserved for a woman of 45. What made her state of preservation even more remarkable was the story she now told of how she had spent the past 15 years. She was captured and raped in the Crimea, she said. She was shipped to the Ukraine by boxcar, was put to work in a labor gang. We were stumbling sluts, she said, married to mud. When the war was over, nobody bothered to tell us. Our tragedy was permanent. No records were kept of us anywhere. We shuffled through ruined villages aimlessly. Anyone who had a menial, pointless job to do had only to wave us down and we would do it. She separated herself from me in order to tell her yarn with larger gestures. I wandered over to my front window to listen. Listen while looking through dusty panes into the twigs of a birdless, leafless tree. Drawn crudely in the dust of three window panes were a swastika, a hammer and sickle, and the stars and stripes. I had drawn the three symbols weeks before, at the conclusion of an argument about patriotism with Kraft. I had given a hearty cheer for each symbol, demonstrating to Kraft the meaning of patriotism to, respectively, a Nazi, a communist, and an American. Hooray, 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 I'd said. On and on Helga spun her yarn, weaving a biography on the crazy loom of modern history. She escaped from the labor gang after 2 years, she said, was caught a day later by Asiatic halfwits with submachine guns and police dogs. She spent 3 years in the prison, she said, and then she was sent to Siberia as an interpreter and file clerk in a huge prisoner of war camp. 8,000 SS men were still held captive there, though the war had been over for years. I was there for 8 years, she said, mercifully hypnotized by simple routines. We kept beautiful records of all those prisoners, of all those meaningless lives behind barbed wire. Those SS men, once so young and lean and vicious, were growing gray and soft and self-pitying, she said. Husbands without wives, fathers without children, shopkeepers without shops, tradesmen without trades. Thinking about the subdued SS men, Helga asked herself the riddle of the Sphinx. What creature walks in the morning on 4 feet, at noon on 2, at evening on 3? Man, said Helga huskily. She told of being repatriated. Repatriated after a fashion. She was returned not to Berlin, but to Dresden, in East Germany. She was put to work in a cigarette factory, which she described in oppressive detail. One day she ran away to East Berlin, then crossed to West Berlin. Days after that she was winging to me. Who paid your way? I said.
Admirers of yours, said Jones warmly. Don't feel you have to thank them. They feel they owe you a debt of gratitude they'll never be able to repay.
For what? I said.
For having the courage to tell the truth during the war, said Jones, when everybody else was telling lies.
Chapter 17. August Krapthauer goes to Valhalla. Vize-Bundesführer Krapthauer, on his own initiative,
went down all those stairs to get my Helga's luggage from Jones's limousine. The reunion of Helga and me had made him feel young and courtly again. Nobody knew what he was up to until he reappeared in my doorway, with a suitcase in either hand. Jones and Keeley were filled with consternation because of Kraptauer's syncopated, leaky old heart. The Vizebundesführer was the color of tomato juice.
"You fool," said Jones. "No, no, I'm perfectly fine," said Kraptauer,
smiling.
"Why didn't you let Robert do it?" said Jones.
Robert was his chauffeur, sitting in the limousine below. Robert was a colored man, 73 years old. Robert was Robert Sterling Wilson, erstwhile jailbird, Japanese agent, and Black Führer of Harlem.
"You should have let Robert bring those things up," said Jones. "My gosh, you mustn't risk your life like that." "It is an honor to risk my life," said Kraptauer. "For the wife of a man who served Adolf Hitler as well as Howard Campbell did."
And he dropped dead. We tried to revive him, but he was stone dead, slack-mouthed, obscenely gaga. I ran down to the second floor, where Dr. Abraham Epstein lived with his mother. The doctor was home. Dr. Epstein treated poor old Kraptauer pretty roughly, forced him to demonstrate for us all how really dead he was. Epstein was Jewish, and I thought Jones or Keeley might say something to him about the way he was punching and poking Kraptauer. But the two antique fascists were childishly respectful and dependent. About the only thing Jones said to Epstein after Epstein had pronounced Kraptauer very dead was,
"I happen to be a dentist, doctor."
"That's so," said Epstein. He wasn't much interested. He went back to his own apartment to call an ambulance. Jones covered Kraptauer with one of my war surplus blankets.
"Just when things were finally beginning to look up for him again,"
he said of the death. "In what way?" I said.
"He was beginning to get a little organization going again," said Jones. "Not a big thing, but loyal, dependable, devoted."
"What was it called?" I said.
"The Iron Guard of the White Sons of the American Constitution," said Jones. "He had a real talent for welding perfectly ordinary youths into a disciplined, determined force."
Jones shook his head sadly.
"He was getting such a fine response from the young people."
"He loved young people, and young people loved him," said Father Keeley. He was still weeping.
"That's the epitaph that should be carved on his tombstone," said Jones. "He used to work with youngsters in my cellar. You should see how he fixed it up for them. Just ordinary kids from all walks of life."
"Kids who would ordinarily be at loose ends and getting into trouble," said Father Keeley.
"He was one of the greatest admirers you ever had," Jones said to me.
"He was?" I said.
"Back when you were broadcasting, he never missed listening to you. When he went to prison, the first thing he did was build a shortwave receiver just so he could go on listening to you. Every day he was bubbling over with the things you'd said the night before."
I said.
"You were a beacon, Mr. Campbell,"
said Jones passionately.
"Do you realize what a beacon you were through all those black years?"
"Nope," I said.
"Kraptauer had hoped you'd be the idealism officer for the Iron Guard," said Jones.
"I'm the chaplain," said Keeley.
"Oh, who will lead the Iron Guard now?" said Jones. "Who will step forward and pick up the fallen torch?"
There was a sharp, strong knock on the door. I opened the door, and outside stood Jones's chauffeur. a wrinkled old colored man with malevolent yellow eyes. He wore a black uniform with white piping, a Sam Brown belt, a nickel-plated whistle, a Luftwaffe hat without insignia, and black leather puttees. There was no Uncle Tom in this cotton-haired old colored man. He walked in arthritically, but his thumbs were hooked into his Sam Brown belt. His chin was thrust out at us, and he kept his hat on.
"Everything all right up here?" he said to Jones. "He was up here so long."
"Not quite," said Jones. "August Kraptauer died." The Black Führer of Harlem took the news in stride.
"All dying. All dying," he said. "Who's going to pick up the torch when everybody's dead?"
"I just asked the same question myself," said Jones. He introduced me to Robert. Robert didn't shake hands.
"I heard about you," he said, "but I ain't never listened to you."
"Well," I said, "you can't please all the people all of the time."
"We was on opposite sides," said Robert.
"I see," I said. I didn't know anything about him, was agreeable to his belonging to any side that suited him.
"I was on the colored folks' side," he said. "I was with the Japanese."
"Uh-huh," I said.
"We needed you, and you needed us," he said,
speaking of the alliance between Germany and Japan in the Second World War.
"Only there was a lot of things we couldn't, what you call, agree about."
"I guess that's so," I said.
"I mean, I heard you say you don't think the colored people were so good," said Robert.
"Now, now," said Jones soothingly. "What useful purpose does it serve for us to squabble among ourselves? The thing to do is to pull together."
"I just want to tell him what I tell you," said Robert. "I tell this reverend gentleman here the same thing every morning. The same thing I tell you now. I give him his hot cereal for breakfast, and then I tell him, the colored people are going to rise up in righteous wrath, and they're going to take over the world. White folks going to finally lose."
"All right, Robert," said Jones patiently.
"The colored people going to have hydrogen bombs all their own," he said. "They're working on it right now. Pretty soon gonna be Japan's turn to drop one. The rest of the colored folks gonna give them the honor of dropping the first one."
"Where are they going to drop it?" I said.
"China, most likely," he said.
"On other colored people?" I said. He looked at me pityingly.
"Whoever told you a Chinaman was a colored man?" he said.
Chapter 18. Vernon North's Beautiful Blue Vase. Helga and I were finally left alone. We were shy. Being a man of fairly advanced years, so many of the years having been spent in celibacy, I was more than shy. I was afraid to test my strength as a lover. And the fear was amplified by the remarkable number of youthful characteristics my Helga had miraculously retained. This is what's known as getting to know each other again," I said. Our conversation was in German. "Yes," she said. She had gone to the front window now, was looking at the patriotic devices I'd drawn on the dusty window panes. "Which one of these is you now, Howard?" she said. "Pardon me," I said. "The hammer and the sickle, the swastika, or the stars and stripes?" she said. "Which one do you like the most?" "Ask me about music," I said. "What?" she said.
Ask me what kinds of music I like these days, I said. I have some opinions on music. I have no political opinions at all.
I see, she said. All right. What music do you like these days?
White Christmas, I said. Bing Crosby's White Christmas.
Excuse me, she said.
My favorite piece of music, I said. I love it so much I have 26 copies of it. She looked at me blankly.
You do?
She said. It's a private joke, I said lamely.
Oh, she said.
Private, I said. I've been living alone so long. Everything about me is private. I'm surprised anyone's able to understand a word I say.
I will, she said tenderly. Give me a little time. Not much, but some. And I'll understand everything you say. Again.
She shrugged.
I have private jokes, too.
From now on, I said. We'll make the privacy for two again.
That will be nice, she said.
Nation of two again, I said.
Yes, she said. Tell me.
Anything at all, I said.
I know how father died, but I haven't been able to find out a thing about mother and Racy, she said. Have you heard a word?
Nothing, I said.
When did you see them last? She said.
I thought back. Was able to give the exact date on which I'd last seen Helga's father, mother, and her pretty, imaginative little sister, Resinot. February 12th, 1945, I said. And I told her about that day. That day was a day so cold that it made my bones ache. I stole a motorcycle, and I went calling on my in-laws, on the family of Werner Noth, the chief of police of Berlin. Werner Noth lived on the outskirts of Berlin, well outside the target area. He lived with his wife and daughter in a walled white house that had the monolithic, earthbound grandeur of a Roman nobleman's tomb. In 5 years of total war, that house had not suffered so much as a cracked window pane. Its tall, deep-set windows on the south framed an orchard within the walls. On the north, they framed the jagged monuments in the ruins of Berlin. I was wearing a uniform. At my belt was a tiny pistol and a big, fancy, ceremonial dagger. I didn't usually wear a uniform, but I was entitled to wear one. The blue and gold uniform of a major in the Free American Corps. The Free American Corps was a Nazi daydream. A daydream of a fighting unit composed mainly of American prisoners of war. It was to be a volunteer organization. It was to fight only on the Russian front. It was to be a high-morale fighting machine, motivated by a love of Western civilization and a dread of the Mongol hordes. When I call this unit a Nazi daydream, incidentally, I am suffering an attack of schizophrenia, because the idea of the Free American Corps began with me. I suggested its creation, designed its uniforms and insignia, wrote its creed. That creed began, I, like my honored American forefathers, believe in true freedom. The Free American Corps was not a howling success. Only three American PWs joined. God only knows what became of them. I presume that they were all dead when I went calling on my in-laws, that I was the sole survivor of the Corps. When I went calling, the Russians were only 20 miles from Berlin.
I had decided that the war was almost over, that it was time for my career as a spy to end. I put on the uniform in order to dazzle any Germans who might try to keep me from getting out of Berlin. Tied to the back fender of my stolen motorcycle was a parcel of civilian clothes.
My call on the notes had nothing to do with cunning. I really wanted to say goodbye to them, to have them say goodbye to me. I cared about them, pitied them, loved them in a way. The iron gates of the great white house were open. Werner Note himself was standing beside them, his hands on his hips. He was watching a work gang of Polish and Russian slave women. The women were lugging trunks and furniture from the house to three waiting horse-drawn wagons. The wagon drivers were small gold Mongols of some sort, early prizes of the Russian campaign. The supervisor of the women was a fat, middle-aged Dutchman in a shabby business suit. Guarding the women was a tall and ancient man with a single-shot rifle from the Franco-Prussian War. On the old guard's ruined breast dangled the Iron Cross. A woman slave shuffled out of the house, carrying a luminously beautiful blue vase. She was shod in wooden clogs hinged with canvas. She was a nameless, ageless, sexless rag bag. Her eyes were like oysters. Her nose was frostbitten, mottled white and cherry red. She seemed in danger of dropping the vase, of withdrawing so deeply into herself as simply to let the vase slip away. My father-in-law saw the vase about to drop, and he went off like a burglar alarm. He shrieked at God to have pity on him just once, to make sense just once, to show him just one other energetic and intelligent human being. He snatched the vase from the dazed woman. Close to unashamed tears, he asked us all to adore the blue vase that laziness and stupidity had almost let slip from the world. The shabby Dutchman, the straw boss, now went up to the woman and repeated to her, word for word and shriek for shriek, what my father-in-law had said. The antique soldier came along with him to represent the force that would be used on the woman if necessary. What was finally done with her was curious. She wasn't hurt. She was deprived of the honor of carrying any more of Noth's things. She was made to stand to one side, while others continued to be trusted with treasures. Her punishment was to be made to feel like a fool. She had been given her opportunity to participate in civilization, and she had muffed it. "I've come to say goodbye," I said to Noth.
"Goodbye,"
he said.
"I'm going to the front," I said. "Right over that way," he said, pointing to the east. "An easy walk from here. You can make it in a day, picking buttercups as you go."
"It isn't very likely we'll see each other again, I guess," I said.
"So?"
he said. I shrugged.
"So nothing," I said.
"Exactly," he said. "Nothing and nothing and nothing."
"May I ask where you're moving to?" I said.
"I am staying here," he said. "My wife and daughter are going to my brother's home outside of Cologne."
"Is there anything I can do to help?" I said.
"Yes," he said. "You can shoot Racy's dog. It can't make the trip. I have no interest in it. Will not be able to give it the care and companionship Racy has led it to expect. So shoot it, please."
"Where is it?" I said.
"I think you'll find it in the music room with Racy," he said. "She knows it's to be shot. You will have no trouble with her."
"All right," I said.
"That's quite a uniform," he said.
"Thank you," I said.
"Would it be rude of me to ask what it represents?" he said. I had never worn it in his presence. I explained it to him, showed him the device on the hilt of my dagger. The device, silver on walnut, was an American eagle that clasped a swastika in its right claw and devoured a snake in its left claw. The snake was meant to represent international Jewish communism. There were 13 stars around the head of the eagle, representing the 13 original American colonies. I had made the original sketch of the device, and since I don't draw very well, I had drawn 6-pointed stars of David rather than 5-pointed stars of the USA. The silversmith, while lavishly improving on my eagle, had reproduced my 6-pointed stars exactly. It was the stars that caught my father-in-law's fancy. "These represent the 13 Jews in Franklin Roosevelt's cabinet," he said. "That's a very funny idea," I said. "Everyone thinks the Germans have no sense of humor," he said. "Germany is the most misunderstood country in the world," I said. "You are one of the few outsiders who really understands us," he said. "I hope that's a compliment I deserve," I said. "It's a compliment you didn't come by very easily," he said. "You broke my heart when you married my daughter. I wanted a German soldier for a son-in-law." "Sorry," I said. "You made her happy," he said. "I hope so," I said. "That made me hate you more," he said. "Happiness has no place in war." "Sorry," I said. "Because I hated you so much," he said. "I studied you. I listened to everything you said. I never missed a broadcast." "I didn't know that," I said. "No one knows everything," he said. "Did you know," he said, "that until almost this very moment, nothing would have delighted me more than to prove that you were a spy, to see you shot?" "No," I said. "And do you know why I don't care now if you were a spy or not?" he said. "You could tell me now that you were a spy, and we would go on talking calmly just as we're talking now. I would let you wander off to wherever spies go when a war is over. You know why?" he said. "No," I said. "Because you could never have served the enemy as well as you served us," he said. I realized that almost all the ideas that I hold now, that make me unashamed of anything I may have felt or done as a Nazi, came not from Hitler, not from Goebbels, not from Himmler, but from you. He took my hand. You alone kept me from concluding that Germany had gone insane. He turned away from me abruptly. He went to the oyster-eyed woman who had almost dropped the blue vase. She was standing against a wall where she had been ordered to stand, was numbly playing the punished dunce. Werner Nott shook her a little, trying to arouse an atom of intelligence in her. He pointed to another woman who was carrying a hideous Chinese carved oak dog, carrying it as carefully as though it were a baby. "You see?" Nott said to the dunce. He wasn't intentionally tormenting the dunce. He was trying to make her, in spite of her stupidity, a better-rounded, more useful human being. "You see?" he said again, earnestly, helpfully, pleadingly. "That's the way to handle precious things." Chapter 19. Little Resi Nott. I went into the music room of Werner Nott's emptying house and found little Resi and her dog. Little Resi was 10 years old then. She was curled in a wing chair by a window. Her view was not of the ruins of Berlin, but of the walled orchard, of the snowy lace that the treetops made. There was no heat in the house. Resi was bundled up in a coat and scarf and thick wool stockings. A small suitcase was beside her. When the wagon train outside was ready to move, she would be ready to board it. She had taken off her mittens, laid them neatly on the arm of the chair. She had bared her hands in order to pet the dog in her lap. The dog was a dachshund that had, on a wartime diet, lost all its hair and been all but immobilized by a dropsical fat. The dog looked like some early amphibian meant to waddle in ooze. While Racy caressed it, its brown eyes bugged with the blindness of ecstasy. Every bit of its awareness followed like thimbles the fingertips that stroked its hide. I did not know Racy well. She had chilled me once, fairly early in the war, by lispingly calling me an American spy. Since then, I had spent as little time as possible before her childish gaze. When I came into the music room, I was startled to see how much she was coming to resemble my Helga. "Racy?" I said. She didn't look at me. "I know," she said. "It's time to kill the dog." "It isn't anything I want to do very much," I said. "Are you going to do it?" she said. "Or are you going to give it to somebody to do?" "Your father asked me to do it," I said. She turned to look at me. "You're a soldier now," she said. "Yes," I said. "Did you put on your uniform just for killing the dog?" she said. "I'm going to the front," I said. I stopped by to say goodbye. "Which front?" she said. "The Russians," I said. "You'll die," she said. "So I hear," I said. "Maybe not." "Everybody who isn't dead is going to be dead very soon now," she said. She didn't seem to care much. "Not everybody," I said. "I will be," she said. "I hope not," I said. "I'm sure you'll be fine," I said. "It won't hurt when I get killed," she said. "Just all of a sudden I won't be anymore," she said. She pushed the dog off her lap. It fell to the floor as passive as a knockwurst. "Take it," she said. "I never liked it anyway. I just felt sorry for it." I picked up the dog. "It will be much better off dead," she said. "I think you're right," I said. "I'll be better off dead too," she said. "That I can't believe," I said. "Do you want me to tell you something?" she said. "All right," I said. "Since nobody's going to go on living much longer," she said, "I might as well tell you I love you." "That's very sweet," I said. "I mean really love you," she said. "When Helga was alive, and you two would come here, I used to envy Helga. When Helga was dead, I started dreaming about how I would grow up and marry you, and be a famous actress, and you would write plays for me." "I am honored," I said. "It doesn't mean anything," she said. "Nothing means anything. You go shoot the dog now." I bowed out, taking the dog with me. I took the dog out into the orchard, put it down in the snow, drew my tiny pistol. Three people were watching me. One was Racy, who now stood at the music room window. Another was the ancient soldier who was supposed to be guarding the Polish and Russian women. The third was my mother-in-law, Ava Not. Ava Not stood at a second-story window. Like Razy's dog, Ava Not had fattened dropsically on wartime food. The poor woman, made into a sausage by unkind time, stood at attention, seemed to think that the execution of the dog was a ceremony of some nobility. I shot the dog in the back of the neck. The report of my pistol was small, cheap, like the tinny spit of a BB gun. The dog died without a shudder. The old soldier came over, expressing a professional's interest in the sort of wound such a small pistol might make. He turned the dog over with his boot, found the bullet in the snow, murmured judiciously, as though I had done an interesting, instructive thing. He now began to talk of all sorts of wounds he had seen or heard of, all sorts of holes in once living things.
"You're going to bury it?"
he said. "I suppose I'd better," I said.
"If you don't," he said, "somebody will eat it."